Our next conversation takes in two very intertwined topics. One I've been writing about for 60 years, our relationship to death, our denial of death. And the other, the new advances in genetic medicine that will help prolong life. My next guest, GP and author Leah Kaminsky, first got interested in genomic medicine when a young patient of hers developed a rare disease, and unable to find a diagnosis, his parents pressed to have his DNA sequenced and then painstakingly analysed until they identified the genetic causes. Now, since then, Leah's been fascinated by the potential for genetic medicine. Now, she's written a really good essay in the new Griffith Review about the future of genetic medicine, and she's also has a new book out called We're All Going to Die, published by HarperCollins. So here we go with DNA and death. Leah, welcome.
Thanks, Philip.
Tell us about the case of your patient, Massimo Damiani.
Yeah, little Massimo, he's now seven, but when he was little baby, 6 weeks old, his parents, Stephen and Sally Damiani, quite remarkable people, came in for his normal six-week baby check. And I'm a local GP and went through my system of examining him and found a couple of abnormalities. And there's a triad, a little secret I'll let your listeners into, that when you see one thing wrong, you always look for three things. That's what we're trained as medical students. And I suspected something was wrong with this child, but, you know, we had some routine tests done and there was just a little bit of problem with his spinal cord, nothing terrible. But a year later, little Massimo started regressing and losing a lot of his abilities. He was choking on his food, he was falling, all of his milestones were going backwards. And this took his parents and the medical team on a diagnostic odyssey, quite a hideous one that took a long, long time. His father, Stephen, was an IT geek who just basically said, it's just number crunching. You know, all we need to do to figure out what this mystery illness is that no one can diagnose is map my entire DNA profile, my wife's and my son's, and then just cut out the white noise. Well, back in the day in 2009, that had never been done and was, you know, we're talking numbers that were incomprehensible. Stephen and Sally were sort of a modern day Lorenzo's oil in the time of the internet. And to cut a long story short, I've also helped them write a book about their journey. They ended up diagnosing a completely unheard of genetic illness in their son through getting their DNA mapped and finding a bioinformatics scientist, Ryan Taft in Queensland, to basically work on it in his own time. It was quite an extraordinary journey.
And it's a journey you're still on, of course. Now, a couple of years ago, you had an opportunity to have your DNA sequenced. Tell us about that.
That was quite trippy. I was invited to San Diego to Illumina, which was the genomics company that helped with the diagnosis of little Massimo. And they had a key opinion leaders summit. And I sort of went along for the ride. And as part of the deal, we were offered to have our entire DNA mapped, our what's called our genome. And so I was one of 550 people in the world at the time that had their entire genome mapped and interpreted. And leading up to that was, let's say, anxiety-provoking, Phil.
I would have thought so. So for 4 months, you were nervously awaiting the results.
Well, the 4 months followed, you know, my entire life of nervously awaiting for whatever that kind of crappy gene that I was sure I'd inherited would get me. I come from good Ashkenazi Jewish stock, and we were behind the door when the good Lord gave out the Scrabble tray of genes, so quite a heavy stacking of nasty genetic illnesses. So it wasn't a matter of when I was going to get it in my little neurotic brain, having seen everything I'd seen as a doctor too. It was when I was going to have, you know, inherit the breast cancer gene or something. I was quite sure that that was going to happen. So
that's one of the reasons I wouldn't want to know, because within the range of conventional medicine, every time I go to the doctors, it's bad news. Now, Leah, we should point out that a decade ago it cost 2 billion smackers to map the first human genome. How much does it cost now?
You can get it done. I mean, you can shop around, but you can get it done for under $1,000 if you want to.
So it's pretty accessible.
5 mils of blood. Nowadays it is, yeah.
For an apparently healthy person, what's the point of mapping one's DNA medically and psychologically? Well, let me put it another way. Do you recommend it to patients in your practice as a GP?
Look, for me personally, it was quite liberating. You know, I lucked out for the time being, let's say. You know, I won the genetic crapshoot in this round, if we're talking in boxing terms. Because I was lucky, nothing was discovered. But that's only the genes that we know of now. And there's no guarantee that there's going to be genes discovered in the future that I don't carry, or that I walk out of here tonight, Philip, and get hit by a bus. There are no guarantees.
Don't you dare. Don't you dare, Leah. You look to the left, look to the right.
I shall.
And look to the left again.
But what I'm saying, Philip, is that there's no guarantees. But Ryan Taft, the scientist who's now the chief scientific, he was a lab rat at the time, and he's now chief scientific officer at Illumina. You know, he said to me when I was researching all of this, the future's already arrived. It's just that the general public doesn't know about it. So now, this genomic revolution is upon us. It's here.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I understand that DNA can help diagnose risk, but what can it help? Does it help yet in treating an illness?
It certainly in some avenues does, yes. It's, the whole idea of personalised medicine or genomics, that is, we've moved on from the one-size-fits-all modern medicine where we're basically our roadmap is watch for waiting, and often that's too late for a patient. So when you're looking at DNA to diagnose tumours or other, rare conditions, you're looking at health predictions that come in at the very earliest stages of illness at one level, but can also preempt disease even before it occurs. So,
I understand that medications for things like depression are proven to have better success if matched to a person's DNA.
Absolutely. You know, if you walk into my consultation room today, Philip, and I don't know whether, the script that I'm going to give you for your antidepressant, if you're depressed, is going to cause a nasty side effect. It's guesswork.
Well, the one you gave me last time was called left-wing bias.
No. That was a while ago.
Yeah, but that's your fault.
I've been following you for a while.
I blame you for that. But so you make the point that genetic testing shows us that we need to personalise medicine. I've always been fascinated how people have different reactions to medication and treatment.
Well, I think we're eventually going to find out most of that is in our genes, and that it's just a matter of time before we can map all of that. And, it's already happening. And I think the pharmaceutical industry is following in the wake of that. You know, you asked me why did I have my genome mapped, aside from just trying to alleviate my own anxiety. I mean, honestly, it's a way that I could donate my body to science without having to die first. I sat through cadaver dissections. I know what medical students do. And in this way, I think, the research into DNA at the moment is very much dependent on siloing the information. And the more we can get, the more DNA profiles we can get, the more we learn. And it's not without its pitfalls, and I'm not saying it's 100% foolproof for sure.
Tell me about gene editing. What is it?
Gosh, I'm a GP. I generalise, I sort of specialise in being general. So just as an overview, which is pretty much all I really know, what there are certain techniques, and one in particular, which has been written about quite a lot in the general press lately, is CRISPR, where they basically, it's like taking a pair of scissors and cutting out the unwanted gene or replacing them with proper genes with stem cells. So it's quite a complex field. It's a nascent field, but it's certainly growing and showing a lot of promise. But again, you know, I think we need to be very careful that the science doesn't get ahead of the bioethics, and that's why I'm really, really keen to get public discussion.
I'm going to quote a very authoritative source called Leah Kaminsky. Oh. In much the same way as you hit the delete button on your computer to remove a typo, CRISPR operates like a genetic scalpel to change or replace genes and inside the cell. Now, how are doctors reacting? There must be many who are sceptical of the potential or openly hostile.
Look, one of the best quotes I heard at this summit came from a scientist by the name of Howard Jacobs, and he put it beautifully. We were talking about why hasn't this taken on more, why hasn't the profession accepted personalised medicine? And he said, the king never calls for revolution. We'd put ourselves out of business. And I think that's precisely, in a sense, what we need to do, in a way, is put ourselves out of business to some degree.
So the art of medicine was diagnosis, and the rituals that one still goes through are quite ancient, aren't they? You know, the tapping of the knee, the funny old-fashioned stethoscope.
They're ancient and they're fading. I think, you know, the art of the bedside examination is being lost, and Abraham Verghese writes a lot about this. But I think it's still a crucial, for me, and I'm getting old, I think it's still a very crucial part of the relationship with the patient. That touch, that examination is still, I think, an outward expression of trust, of trying to...
It also reminds us that the GP is also a form of priest for many patients.
I think perhaps we used to be cast in that role, and we certainly used to sit the vigil at the deathbed. But I think that's also that's changing rapidly.
Okay, let's now discuss death rather than DNA. But going back to your own mapping, did it intensify your fear of death? Because I know you've always been afraid of it. Apart from any other factor, you had relatives who died in Holocaust.
I think that, you know, probably formulated a lot of it, but I think more to the point was pretty much my travels through medical school and seeing and as a young doctor, seeing pretty horrific deaths. Or, I'm not that scared of death, let me clarify here. I'm scared of the road trip that at the end that gets you there. So the way we die nowadays, I find really quite terrifying.
40 years ago, I was allowed to make a program on death. And I wandered around talking to morticians, undertakers, coffin makers, all the people who seemed to me worked in the business of death. I understand you've done something similar.
Yeah, well, 40 years ago, Philip, I was probably reading your essays and don't remember that one, pardon me. So maybe
it was a television show called See It My Way that I did for the ABC.
Okay. Well, I wish I would have watched it then, but maybe I did and I'd forgotten about it. But I guess I woke up one morning about 5 years ago and just suddenly realised I'm a doctor and I'm terrified of death. That's just not, you know, that shouldn't come with the gig. And if I'm feeling that way, how many others in my profession are feeling that way? And at the time, there wasn't a hell of a lot written or discussed about death. Since then, you know, Atul Gawande's come out with his wonderful book, and Paul Kalanithi, and Caitlin Doherty's written her beautiful book on you know, being a funeral director. So I think the discussion and death cafes, death by dinner, it's sort of everywhere you look now. And as I was writing the book, I just wanted to go where my nose sort of led me. I started with my patients that had really, and I hate to use the word inspired because it sounds like inspiration porn, but really had made me reflect on mortality, who had been confronted with mortality themselves, and not just elderly patients, because we tend to focus our discussions of death on the elderly, but from womb to tomb, you know, from women who'd had miscarriages or stillbirths through to young children who were confronted with mortality. And patients of mine who'd been daredevils. So I guess in a similar way to you, I just went and spoke to anyone that had anything to do with death.
The daredevils are an interesting subgroup, aren't they? Because they challenge death. They confront it in this very theatrical and often reckless way.
Yeah, look, one of the most amazing guys I spoke to is a Melbourne daredevil by the name of Ariel Manx, and he's quite incredible. He holds the world record for sword swallowing. I'm not going to get this right. Something about the number of backflips you can do while swallowing a sword. The guy's extraordinary. And he says his happy place, his place of transcendence, is when he actually is standing on his hands with a sword down his gullet. And that's when he feels timeless.
Don't mock it, Leah. Try it.
After you, Philip.
Don't do this at home, listeners. Yeah. Okay. And, of course, one of the things you'd have to do is often give a patient the bad news.
Yeah. I think I've been very poorly trained in that. And I think I was very relieved to hear that medical students are now being taught what we call in the business BBN, breaking bad news, and they're being trained in that. When I came out, you know, nobody taught us how to do that. Nobody even discussed it. We didn't discuss death. We didn't discuss dying. It was something you sort of learn on the job or don't.
It's interesting that you and I are sitting in the 21st century, looking back on the 20th, in which almost 200 million people died in wars and genocides. And yet there are still many Australians in their 40s, 50s and 60s who have never seen a dead person.
Absolutely, because we sanitise death. It's off stage. It occurs, you know, down in the bottom floor of the basement of the hospital. It occurs in nursing homes that are sequestered from our daily lives. It really does. We don't, and you know, even our meat is packaged so that it's unrecognisable as once an animal. I think it's a culture of denialism.
But it was denied at both ends. I remember the battle to see my first child born. I was shoved outside. It wasn't encouraged. It was both the beginning and the end of life that was hidden.
Well, you know, that's interesting because Sheila Kitzinger, who really revolutionised the plan of birthing and brought the fathers or the partners back into the birthing room. When she died, she also wanted to revolutionise, you know, and have a death plan and fought tooth and nail to bring in planning for death in the same way she did planning for birth. So I think, you know, these people like her are shaking things up. And I think baby boomers are not going to die quietly. Let's face it. You know, we went through the sexual revolution. I think we need a revolution in talking about death, because if we sanitise death, we also sanitise life. It's a flip side. So I'm talking about death, but what I'm really talking about is life.
You were recently on a Sydney Writers' Festival panel with, amongst others, Andrew Denton, who has made a 17-episode podcast called Better Off Dead about the right to die with dignity. What is your public position on voluntary euthanasia?
My public position is the same as my private position, and after that session, Andrew and I went off and had, you know, a two-hour coffee together discussing it, because I do not know. And I'm setting myself up as a guinea pig. I'm not that clever that I have all the answers, but I certainly have a hell of a lot of questions. And what I really would like is a huge public forum, including my profession, to discuss this, because we never formally discussed it. It's all ad hoc training. And I think Andrew, you know, is very forthright in what he believes, and I respect that. I think I cannot make up my mind and make any decisions until this discussion has really been had deeply and formally and publicly. I think, and what Andrew actually, you know, was very complimentary of my book, and what he said it opened up to him was that doctors are a really crucial part, the medical profession is a crucial part of this discussion, because even if we're talking about doctor-assisted suicide, I'm the one that goes home at night and has to sleep. And, you know, I'm the one that's provided you with the tools to do what you need to do. So I somehow psychologically need to unpack that, and I don't currently have the wherewithal.
Let's go back to where we began, to DNA and the other means of prolonging life. As a doctor, do you sometimes wonder about the bigger picture of all this effort for us to linger on?
Oh, absolutely, Philip. My son, you know, brought me way down to earth one day over dinner when I was, you know, talking about the, you know, how wonderful my profession is, and it was the only thing I ever wanted to do, and hoping he'd sort of, you know, don the white coat. And he turned around and he said, you know, I won't quote him, but pretty much what he was saying is that we're changing nature's game plan for the planet, and that by prolonging life and you know, this radical increase in longevity, it's not sustainable. And I had to really stop in my tracks and say, well, you know what? He's right.
Leah, we've only got seconds left. In your experience, does religious faith help people die?
I think if you're religious, it potentially does. I cannot do a one-size-fits-all, and I think what may help you die is knowing that you've lived well.
And on that uplifting note, I shall take my leave of you, Leah. Leah Kaminsky, GP and writer. The book is We're All Going to Die, which has come as a great shock to many of the listeners, a joyful book about death, published by HarperCollins. On our next, can super corals save reefs from death? Stick around now on RN for the news, which will be chock-a-block with death, and we'll see you later.